Hello and welcome to the Echo Chamber podcast. My name is Tony Groves, and today we're hoping to pretend that we can look at, beyond Trumpism. Martin, you kind of take a lot of your way you behave from the Trump playbook.
Yeah. I'm going to give you a Trumpism now. Money, okay? These podcasts cost money. Please tell your friends about them. Stick your hand in your pocket. Patreon.com/tortoiseshack. You know it makes sense.
I want to say on the bigger Tortoise Shack, Police Season 2 is starting back on Thursday, but we are also launching a little mini series of Police on the Beat, and it's going to be it's going to be Patreon only. So this is, we have to actually give some content to the people who actually keep this show on the road. Anyway, enough plugging. We're delighted to be rejoined on the in the Tortoise Shack by our friend in Minnesota, Seamus Malika Fazali. Seamus, how are you keeping?
Immensely relieved. Just feeling good for the first time in a very long time. It's this immense amount of stress just kind of like lifted off of the shoulders that I didn't know was on there for a while.
And you would have been one of the least stressed, I would have imagined, in terms of, you know, because your concerns politically are obviously very broad and it's not necessarily always domestic. But you must have known the last 4 years just felt different, surely.
Oh, yeah. I didn't know how different they felt until, like, I saw that Biden had won. And I was just like, really? Like, Trump is not going to, like, I'm not going to have to see, like, Mike Pompeo.
Yeah.
Make these speeches and all these like different threats, and it's just, oh, things are going to be at least slightly different. Like, to be clear, I don't support Biden. Biden is not going to, I think, fundamentally change things. He literally said nothing is going to fundamentally change. But I'm just very happy that Trump lost. Yeah. Like, oh my God, just the amount of cope that you're seeing from Trump supporters, this desperate flailing of insisting that there's fraud. I mean, very, very juicy to see, in all honesty.
Can I just, I want to start with a real light note, which I thought was really, really good this week. America's democracy, you just referenced the legal challenges and the fact that, you know, it's more 70 million people still voted for Donald Trump, and the country is still clearly polarized, and it haven't come together. And I saw in the midst of this that that America was sending international observers to oversee the Ivory Coast elections to make sure that they were free.
No, I mean, the United States never had a leg to stand on when it came to like criticizing other people's elections, but now they really don't. After like this, I mean, they spent decades talking about banana republics, false voter fraud, criticizing other countries, even when they're democratically elected. And now the president of the United States is saying that the election that he himself oversaw as a leader of the country is fraudulent, and that there are millions of illegal votes, and he's refusing to concede. Just madness. Finally, everything that the State Department has pushed over the past decades has finally come home to roost. And it's astonishing to see.
Martin.
Sorry, Tony. I was just listening to Seamus there. But there is still a sense, Seamus, that it's a very divided community. Trump may be gone, but the fire he lit's still there.
Yes, yes. I mean, the Trump legal team has been pushing these kind of very, very desperate attempts to stop the voting or stop the counts or whatever. But supporters are still very much in the streets. In Portland, in DC, all these different places trying to do that. And obviously, I mean, even if Trump decides that he's going to pack up and leave at some point, that ideology that he propagated, that nationalism that he pushed, is not going to go away, obviously. I mean, I saw in The Hill, they were talking about maybe Tucker Carlson running in 2024.
Yeah, that's been rumored.
Tom Cotton.
So's your friend Mike Pompeo, by the way.
Oh God, nah. They were talking about Mike Pompeo, and for a while I thought, you know what? Actually, that might be a real threat. But then I saw him speak at the Republican National Convention, And I don't know if that got any airplay over in Ireland, but if you see, good for good reason, but the speech that he gave, it was one of the most uncharismatic things I've ever seen in my entire life.
When he
Trump,
He tried it. He definitely tried to put himself forward by appearing in Jerusalem just before this. But I also want to pick up on one point that's gone under the radar. It's been heavily criticized, but show me one man who hasn't woken up outside a sex shop and a crematorium while at a landscaping thing, and I'll show you a liar. I mean,
Tony told me, like, okay, we're going to try to keep this to like 30 minutes. It's like, you cannot talk about like all the stupid things that happened in between. Like, they clearly, some person from the Trump campaign was told, okay, we're going to book a big press conference. Let's go Four Seasons Hotel, Philadelphia. It's like, oh, do you mean someone just looked at Google Maps for Four Seasons, misspelled it, and got the landscaping and then called them? And then the landscaping people didn't say, "Oh, this is clearly a mistake." No, we're gonna ask you like how much money,
I do have relatives everywhere, Seamus, you know, and that just smacks of my relatives, smacks of
opportunists. I genuinely remember going to work on a Thursday and waking up in Helsinki, and I just keep thinking, you know, this is the sort of stuff that would happen when you were just, you went a bit mad, like, you know, but it's all, I want to actually move into a little bit more serious, just in terms of things that we can change now. Okay, so, you know, America just came out of the Paris Climate Accord a couple of days ago. That can be undone with executive order. The Iran deal, what do you think the chances are of, I don't think the Iran deal as first structured is still in play, but are there changes that could happen there that could actually benefit diplomacy?
That's the thing. Right now, a couple hours before we recorded this, Elliot Abrams, our favorite Elliot Abrams, orchestrator of multiple genocides in Latin America, he is currently on tour throughout the Gulf states, and he's currently meeting with Netanyahu right now to discuss a pretty massive sanctions program. At least that's the public reason for it, on Iran. The plan, according to Axios, is that they're going to announce big sanctions packages on Iran every week up until January 20th. The idea, and these are not related to the nuclear program, they're related to Iranian ballistics programs, military programs, that kind of thing. And the idea is that the more sanctions that they could put on Iran, the less flexibility Biden has to remove them, to get diplomacy started with Iran, and to make conflict on Israel's terms, especially, much more inevitable, much harder to pivot out of in any single way. Because Biden obviously wants this. What's been talked about is that he wants to reappoint the energy secretary that he had during the Obama administration, which was instrumental to the Iran deal. So he's moving towards that direction. But Trump is going to try everything in his power. He's been doing everything in his power, but he's trying even more so right now to prevent diplomacy happening at any time during the Biden administration.
And so, just to come in on that, though, I made the point, we were on a live pod earlier today. I made the point literally in between things. I said everybody needs to keep an eye on what's happening with Israel, because they've traditionally used the transition phase to do what is disgracefully called mowing the lawn. You know, whether it's taking more land or claiming more territories and you know, whatever phraseology we use, these disputes that take place, what they do is they steal more land. And when you, it's interesting that you say that they've decided that, well, we've only got till Biden comes in to actually pile up these sanctions. So that way, any concessions Biden gives, they're already on top of, you know, they're 300% worse. And if he gives them a 50% decrease, well, then, you know, they're still 250% worse off than they are today. Is that the kind of logic to this?
Basically. So right now, I mean, the real The Iranian rial recently rebounded due to Biden's victory in the election because they're anticipating that kind of diplomacy. But I believe it was the settlements minister said that Biden's victory would lead to war with Iran. As long as Iran's economy stays basically under America's heel, completely under America's heel, then this perpetual cycle of war, of pushing toward war under Netanyahu can continue. And using that transition period, not necessarily with Palestine right now, because they demolished a village a week or so ago, but there haven't been many Muslim annexations. Their main thing is going to be with Iran. It's going to be a mess.
You pointed out earlier today on Twitter, and actually it was one of our listeners that put me onto it as well. And we'd spoken to Hannah Salah in Gaza a few months ago, and you know the issues with what we're seeing now in terms of the arrests that have taken place, the people who are on strike at the moment, and the eyes of the world are looking the other way. So, you know, while you're saying there's no new annexations to take, there's very little land left to bloody take, because they've now got these, and we use the term because we put it in apartheid South Africa sort of terminology, there's kind of these Bantustans that exist of little hubs that have all been broken up. But the situation in Palestine is really, 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 really shit. Like, everybody I speak to is, you know, it hasn't improved. The COVID situation hasn't improved anything. And now we're looking at that. Do you think Biden at all has any kind, like, 'cause he has got a slightly anti-war, he's got some stuff in the slightly anti-war to his credit. You know, he did go against Obama at one stage for over troops that when he was vice president.
It's a bit. Biden is in a very sticky situation right now, and it relates to the Iran thing and with the Palestine thing. So the object of these sanctions on Iran are meant, they're on ballistic missiles. And they're meant to mean that if Biden wants to remove these sanctions in the future, he runs into damaging his relationship with Israel, Netanyahu, because Netanyahu can easily just go, you're removing these sanctions on Iran's military. That means that you want Israel to be destroyed and this perpetual cycle continue where relations worsen. Because if you remember, back during the Obama years, I mean, Netanyahu congratulated Biden today. But during the Obama years, I mean, Netanyahu, I mean, there's no really word for it, fucking hated Obama.
Did hate him.
He went to Congress and basically made an address to Congress, like, against Obama's reelection and against his administration. So even if Biden necessarily, I wouldn't characterize him as necessarily anti-war, but just kind of pulling it back from the brink right now in regards to Palestine, in regards to Iran, he has no leverage to do that. Because any move that he makes to simmer down tensions will inadvertently ratchet them up with Israel and cause that breach and remove any leverage he has to make things even marginally better. As not necessarily out of the goodness of his own heart, but as some sort of attempt at a larger détente.
Is there anything he can do? Is there any positive steps he can do to step it back?
With Palestine or with Iran or both?
With both.
With Palestine, I'm not sure. The thing that has kept it's again. I mean, Palestine is not a good situation right now, obviously, but it's they're in a very odd one right now with the UAE Israel deal, because the UAE made a deal for recognition with Israel based on the idea that they would stop annexation up until 2024, but when they were asked if Israel decided to annex territory before then, would the UAE withdraw recognition? They said no, and it wouldn't affect the withdrawal at all. So they're in a bit of a, you know, will they, won't they situation there. But Israel obviously holds all the cards there. So I don't think Biden really has an option there, because what, is he going to dive into the UAE-Israel deal and say that it's bad? No. Is he going to try to do anything else? Probably not. With Iran, he has more leverage. He can remove some of the the nuclear-related sanctions, stuff that was reimposed by the U.S. unilaterally through snapback and stuff like that. But with all the other sanctions, which are non-nuclear-related, stuff on Iran's banking system, stuff on Iran's shipments, those are not within he doesn't have really the political ammunition to really do that.
And
the nuclear stuff is related to that as well.
Yeah, but they're the parts that actually, you know, we only have to remember that was the UN themselves said that some of the sanctions that the US imposed on Iraq killed 500,000 Iraqi children. I mean, you know, this
yeah,
stuff.
Biden, I don't want to let Biden completely off the hook here because Biden has been, Biden literally voted for the Iraq war. He is responsible in many ways for the situation that Iran is in right now by pushing America's hands into the Middle East so much. But he, because of that, he really doesn't have much to do here, unfortunately. He can make attempts toward that, but it also hinges on what happens in Iran's presidential election next year as well.
Yeah, that is the aspect that no one talks about. It's as if we imagine that Iran and these countries like Lebanon, they're just going to remain static, and we'll make in the West the decisions that are going to take place, and we don't understand what's happening on the ground in those places. I just want to bring it back though, if I can. Again, frustratingly, you know, people are talking about it in terms of a victory for the left and Joe Biden as a victory for the radical left was one of the phrases I thought I heard a few times today. We wouldn't consider Joe Biden at all of the left in terms of our politics and our ideology, I suppose, in our terms. Is he actually seen as of the left now? Or is that how it's the Overton window has moved?
I would say if you talk to anyone on the left in the United States, they would disagree pretty much wholeheartedly. I mean, this is a larger discussion, but I mean, in any other country, Joe Biden would be, you know, he'd be with the Tories in the UK. Like Democratic Party operatives, they supported the Tories against Corbyn because that's where they aligned on the kind of the global political spectrum. But here, I think it's the right word that's where they are. No, I mean, Biden ran on a more conservative platform than Hillary Clinton did in 2016. This man is as liberal as they come in the American political context. Kamala Harris, I mean, you know, she called herself California's top cop, someone who is an agent of those systems. Biden said he would veto any sort of universal healthcare program. Talking to billionaire donors saying that nothing would fundamentally change. There is no sense that this is, right wingers might say this victory for the far left.
That's where I would say it's actually the right wing narrative creeping into the mainstream. And in fact, Democrats lost for any association with socialism. And there is no way you can say Biden is of the left. He's not. He's very much center right. He's just a more acceptable face of center right than we'll say some of his contemporaries out there. As Tony said earlier, he does empathy really well.
Yeah, the empathy thing. I mean, I have no doubt in my mind that Biden, on a personal level, is a very empathetic person. I mean, there were those leaked texts with his son, who was in drug rehabilitation. They were very sweet. They were very charming. However, him being personally empathetic has no bearing on his actual policy. That empathy does not extend into the war in Iraq, the war in Afghanistan, a war, the latter of which he has promised to continue almost indefinitely with a large troop presence. It doesn't connect to healthcare. It doesn't connect to mass incarceration. It doesn't connect to really anything. It's more, you know, empathetic than, you know, Trump, but like most things are it's kind of difficult to get less than him.
Aidan Regan put it, who's one of our frequent guests and a social policy in UCD, he put it that what's called leftism in the USA is liberalism in Europe, and woke liberal culture has many problems, but the main issue is depoliticizing economic inequality and social class without politicizing cultural diversity. So you know, we try to not even use the term culture wars, but I keep hearing it on US mainstream news channels, and they're going, oh, we have to get over this culture war stuff. Isn't culture war just another way to keep people busy, to understand that actually what's happening is the system is screwing you, but, you know, let's blame one another as opposed to how things are set up to serve the other. And it's a two-part question, because it goes back to what the quote about that when the Constitution was written, the architect of it had put into it that the Constitution is designed to serve the opulent, to make sure to limit the voice of the majority. Surely that's the problem.
We've been going for culture war stuff for a very, very long time, but Pat Buchanan back in like 1992 really put that term into the mainstream. I don't know how it is in Ireland, but I can't imagine it's too much better. But there is really not a lot of class analysis in journalism, in political discussion, or anything. I mean, even we have multiple politicians that are elected from the Democratic Socialists of America, but class analysis really doesn't factor in all that much. It's still very politicized in a very non-class lens. We're going to be dealing with this kind of urban versus rural divide, Christian versus irreligious divide kind of thing. But ultimately, I mean, we all know this, at least within this circle. I mean, it's about the rich versus the poor. It's about those who have everything and those who have nothing. Those are the mechanisms. Yeah.
And it's the great unspoken here in Ireland. We've even had some of our top politicians saying that there is no class or no class issues within Ireland.
I don't know what you mean is what was said. I don't know what that means.
What? Yeah.
Leo Varadkar said, I don't know what that means, when it was put to him about class divides. And he actually said, I don't know what that means.
Oh, my God.
But anyway, I'm just going to bring us back one step. Biden is good for us on a very selfish note. He has very quickly come out and stamped his Irish stamp on things. I was listening to one of his voices or his spokespersons today, who said the bottom line for the US will be they will not accept any rollback on the terms of the Good Friday Agreement, because they were involved in it, and they are a guarantor, and it has to be honored. And the second is that any international trade deals, if they step back the Good Friday Agreement, forget all international trade deals with the UK. They're just not going to happen.
Absolutely. I mean, if there is one country that I would say Biden is like almost 100% good on, it's Ireland and Irish affairs. I mean, as you said, Good Friday Agreement, talking about trade deals with the UK to make sure that international law isn't broken, which I'm still astounded that they admitted would break international law, the things they want to deal with.
Only in a very limited sense.
Oh, my God. But, I mean, Biden himself, he's committed to it. He said he's committed to it. He's talked in very strong language about it. And also, I mean, he's met with Gerry Adams multiple times. Just like yesterday, the BBC wanted to speak to him, and he said, "I'm Irish."
It was literally, as I said, the whole country here again. Michael D. meme again. Yay! We've got John King and Joe Biden in a week. Yes.
We absolutely love it.
We're so funny. We're like going, don't you dare give us any of your paddy whackery bullshit. As soon as we comes in our favor, go on, you good thing. We love it. I suppose, that's very positive from an Irish point of view. It's the Brexiteers have been shitting the bed all day on Sky News and all the rest of it. And I mean, genuinely going, I saw Nigel Farage saying Joe Biden hates England, hates them.
Like, he hates the UK.
Yeah, yeah.
He despises it. Like, oh, Nigel, my man. Yeah.
After losing his 10 grand on the bet that he put on Trump to win, like, couldn't have happened to a nicer guy. But I do think America under Trump was very much, there was isolationism at the core of some of his policies, some of the things that he wanted to withdraw from the world. America First was very much some of the most ugly echo of the isolationist past. And then some of the stuff he said almost had that whole blood and soil thing about it. But nonetheless, are we going to see, you don't want to see America become the world police again either. Is there a halfway house?
I mean, even when you describe Trump as an isolationist, I would disagree. He was an isolationist in terms of, you know, European deals with NATO and stuff like that. But with Iran, obviously, this man was not exactly a paragon of non-intervention. Mm. This man brought these two nations to the brink of war. And in other countries, I mean, this happened as well with Venezuela. With the coup attempt by Silvercorp USA, I think was the name of it. I don't know.
Blackwater Mark II.
Yeah, blah, Jesus. But I think Biden is going in a more diplomatic direction, at least slightly. But even if Biden was a peacenik, even if he was as committed to diplomacy and non-intervention as any socialist would, Trump and his cronies have locked any future administration, no matter who it would be, into a very delicate situation of constant escalation that Biden, I don't think, would be able to get himself out of, at least within the Middle East. With Europe, I mean, I don't know if it's really even a discussion. He's going to reestablish those relations. He's going to strengthen stuff with NATO. I don't think that there really is going to be a halfway house, as you said, with the Biden administration, even if he wanted to. There are certain things that have been sent to motion that he cannot pull himself back from in any meaningful way. And the things that he can't control, he's obviously going to move into establishing American privacy back into it.
Yeah. Last question from me, Seamus. What do you think of the old hug a Nazi thing that's going around now at the moment? Hug a Nazi, we call it hug a Nazi, where we need to embrace these
don't rub their noses in it, Seamus. Make sure we're saying to them, you know, I know you were being racist and misogynist and anti-LGBT for the last few years, but here's half my pizza. Let's sit down and talk.
Oh my god. I think I know what you're talking about. Yeah. Because I thought you were saying like a Huguenot. Like, okay, no. Huguenot, no. I mean that's been talked about since like 2016, 2017. It's never gone anywhere. I guess they're trying it up now because I saw like Megyn Kelly say that like, this is how you felt on 2016. It's like, this is not like a sports game. Like people died because of these decisions that you supported. People are currently dying. They're suffering. People don't have medical treatment. Like that's the dumbest thing that I could. It is a movement that only makes sense to you if you view politics like as something that you just view through your window or your TV screen. You don't interact with it.
Perfect. It screams privilege, doesn't it? It screams.
Yes.
You have the ability to say, this hasn't actually, Trump has done all of these things, but I had no skin in the game for the last 4 years. So, hey, let's all be pals. And it's like, and we've seen it here. It's been used by a couple of our own politicians in the last 24 hours to say, oh, you know, be kind to us as well. please, you know, and it's happening. And I do see it. And I, you know, I think everybody in Ireland again was watching Van Jones and Rick Santorum or
And, Van Jones.
Yeah. And that's it. And I mean, that's what I was thinking. I'm going, I've had a lot of problem with Van Jones for a number of years, but we're all caught up in this moment where he's emotional and he's talking as a father. And that's fine. And the other guys on the other side going, well, you felt like this in 2016. So, you know, cut me some slack here. And I'm like, oh God, shut the fuck up, all of you. Seamus, we're gonna wrap it up, but I will ask one thing. I don't know if you've seen it yet. AOC has a piece talking about the fact that she hasn't felt supported within the party. She's felt very much that she's been bullied within the party, and she's felt very much ostracized. Do you think that the results beyond Biden and the results in the trying to take back the House and all the rest of it, is the party itself not ready for more left wing? You know, are they not ready to adopt things like Medicare, like a social safety net? A lot of the things that we take for granted in mainland Europe, to put it a different way.
I mean, that's a huge question to end on. But I think I would think that the Democratic Party, at least right now, is not ready. And I don't think it's going to be ready for at least another, like, maybe even two election cycles, like maybe 8 years. I mean, Biden barely won. And they weren't blaming necessarily Biden's lack of outreach toward Latinos or Black Americans. They started immediately blaming the far left.
Yeah.
And there was his name escapes me, but I believe it was Clyburn. He was on a call and he said that if we run on universal health care, on Medicare for all, on defunding the police, we're going to get creamed like this again. And I'm screaming to the stars. Biden did not run on these policies. Like, you are blaming this, I don't even know what to call it, this phantom.
Yep.
That will end your career, even though a candidate that ran on these policies won the popular vote in Iowa, New Hampshire, and Nevada, the first candidate to ever do that. And the only reason why he lost was because the Democratic establishment just fell into ranks and coalesced behind one candidate who himself had been, you know, getting it like fourth and fifth in his other primaries.
And how quickly we forget that Joe Biden was nowhere to be seen. Bernie Sanders was powering ahead until the forces of the center right all aligned, and in 10 days changed everything.
10 days. Jeez. I mean, the Democratic Party, as it is currently ruled by Nancy Pelosi, by Chuck Schumer, as long as those people are in power and all those mechanisms within the party are owned by them, there is going to be no space for someone like Bernie Sanders. Now, that day is not going to be forever. Eventually, young people are going to be moving into the Democratic Party. They're going to be getting elected to more and more things. Chuck Schumer inevitably is going to have to retire at some point. Nancy Pelosi is going to have to retire at some point. I mean, these people are in their 70s and their 80s. But at this current time, which is a very important time, that's not really something that they're not going to be able to do, unfortunately.
Oh God, that's kind of sad to even hear you talk that way. We've spoken to people in Portugal who've gone from a two-party system. Ireland is on the brink of changing a two-party system. It may be into a different two-party system, but it's still changing. And then, you know, the outlook for America is a two-party system forevermore. It's a really sad state of affairs, really sad state.
Yeah, I mean, the Green Party got, I want to say, like 1.5% of the votes in 2016. It got 2.7% 2000. It's just, you know.
Someone said to me, Jesse Ventura ran for the Green Party. Wasn't he governor in Minnesota for a while?
Oh, Jesse Ventura. No, he didn't run, but the Alaska Green Party was like, we don't accept the National Green nominee. We're just going to nominate Jesse Ventura in our state.
Oh, and
he got like 1,500 votes. Minnesota governor and WWE Hall of Famer Jesse Ventura.
Oh, man.
See, that's the grains all over. They can't decide which side they're on. Anyway.
Seamus, thanks so much for taking the time to talk to us again. And mind yourself and yours. We will be talking to you, no doubt, over the coming weeks as things progress. And we will be watching, because it's going to be, as you said, that transition period and what's going on now. And people should be mindful of this. It's often, and Netanyahu has used this previously as an opportunity to do things while the eyes of the world are on this transition process. And we need to be very mindful of that. Thanks for outlining that for us today.
It's no problem. Happy to come back on.
Listen, folks, patreon.com/tortoiseshack. Please just throw us the price of a cup of coffee. If you met Martin in the shop, would you buy him a cup of coffee and a bun? Because God love him, you know.
I'm the guy sitting outside with the empty cup of coffee.
Yeah, exactly. Look after that old man for us. Talk to you all soon. Take care. Bye bye.
Tony and Martin, Martin and Tony, speaking to interesting people only. It's the Echo Chamber Podcast. Subscribe now on Patreon.